Well, it's a great honor to be doing this, this lecture devoted to Daniel Metter, who has had such a distinguished career as a scholar and as a public servant. And it's also a great pleasure to be here at the University of Virginia, partly at the law school, because there are numbers of people that I know pretty well and have worked with, and a number of them have worked very diligently and excellently in these fields. Just to mention a couple of people, Dick Merrill and I were close friends at Columbia Law School, and he's here, and that's a great pleasure. And Stephen Walt, who's also here, helped me a great deal when I was doing my initial sorting out of some of these issues quite a while ago. I won't mention how many years ago. I'll also mention that I think at the law school at Virginia, there's probably the leading scholar in religion and law, if we count influence on legislation in cases and scholarly work. I think you know who that is. Doug Laycock. Okay, my topic this afternoon is going to be religious reasons and how they compare with public reasons and what their place is in the politics and law of our country. I'm going to focus primarily on arguments about what these places should be, not what they now are, but questions about what should be are closely connected to the descriptive facts and estimates of the facts. I'm going to tackle three separate questions. The first is the place of religious reasons in the formation and justification of positions about what laws should be made. The second inquiry involves the place of these reasons in judicial decisions. And the third question concerns the place of accounts of religious affiliations and convictions in political campaigns. Now, in my previous work, I've always put aside this elusive question about political campaigns, and my views on that are much more tentative than about some of the other things. In respect to religions and public reason, the arguments are ones about legislation and grounds for judicial decision. I'm first going to summarize the basic issues and my positions about these. I'm then going to address some nuances that I've previously paid little or no attention to. And these involve mixtures of public and non-public reasons and the weight to be accorded competing public reasons when they're in conflict. My claim is that some reliance on religious views is nearly inevitable for those whose overarching perspective on reality and human life is religious. A different kind of nuance is the manner in which public reasons for judges vary somewhat from public reasons in political debate. Now, my views on many of these matters are highly controversial, but they are relatively settled. When it comes to the elections, as I've said, my positions are far more tentative, and I doubt whether any generalizations are going to suffice over an extended period of time. And I think any lines we might draw are disturbingly elusive. Nevertheless, I believe we should try to engage in a serious discussion of these questions and not one that's completely focused on what's good for one's candidate at the moment. Now, to understand our subjects, we do have to distinguish these from questions about free exercise and the Establishment Clause. Those issues are raised when the government interferes with or discourages religious practice or sponsors and promotes one or more religions. But there's another fundamental question about religion and the law in our liberal democracy, and that's how far can and should religious convictions underlie legislation or judicial bases of decision when the convictions are employed without any aim to promote or retard religious practice and affiliation. For example, should people rely on religious grounds to support aid for the poor, the abolition of capital punishment, or legal limits on abortion? The place of religious reasons is a constant component in controversy over the role of what are called public reasons. Some of the components in this fundamental issue also figure in discussions about the quality of political candidates. Should they campaign on the basis of their religious convictions and affiliations? and how far should others take these into account? Now, needless to say, this question has some significance for us right now. We have a president running for re-election who's explained his religious background, who recently at a prayer breakfast tied helping the poor to his Christian understanding, who's been criticized for belonging to a church in which the minister made sharply critical comments about, this is a while ago, about our society, and still his very attachment to Christianity has been challenged by some people, I think without any basis in reason. We also have a leading contender for the Republican nomination whose Mormon affiliation is regarded as deeply troublesome by some Americans, and other contenders who's emphasized their religious affiliations and convictions. Gingrich has done this to some extent, and Rick Santorum, when he was touring, did this on the basis of faith, family, and freedom. The idea of public reason is that within a liberal democracy, political decisions should be made on the basis of reasons that derive from premises of liberal democracy and accepted methods of determining facts. The best understanding of what reasons are not public are those that depend on comprehensive views about the nature of human beings and the world around us. Since liberal democracies tolerate a wide diversity of such views, none of them qualify as public reasons that people share. And that's so even if a majority of the population accepts a particular view, such as belief in a loving God. Now, atheism and a Kantian perspective on human nature also don't qualify as public. But given the widespread acceptance of religious perspectives in our country, the views that are most predominantly precluded by public reasons here would be religious ones. Now, there are many nuances in questions about public reasons, and I'm going to mention a number of the central problems very briefly before I go on to the ones that I haven't sort of dealt with much before. And then I'm going to turn to these mixtures and assignments of weight and the special nature of public reasons for judges. A certain skepticism about how far individuals can rely on public reasons, even when they try, affects any appraisal of what political candidates will probably do in office. And I'm going to suggest that sort of an ideal approach is going to have to give way to some reality about problems of prejudice, religious prejudice, and hostility. So first, what's the breadth of application on a theory of public reasons? Now, John Rawls, who's the most prominent proponent of a constraint of public reasons, wrote that he was talking only about constitutional essentials and basic matters of justice. And others have suggested that the constraint applies only to coercive laws. Now, these distinctions may matter for how greatly officials and others should rely on public reasons, but I don't think they yield sensible borders for any sharp differentiation. Think of the question of whether government should finance research on embryonic stem cells, which was a controversial issue, and still is, I think. So opposition to that could be grounded on a religious belief that embryos are entities that must not be harmed. The financing issue is not about coercion and doesn't involve a basic matter of justice. At least, I mean, maybe one could make an argument, but probably not. But we can't expect people to decide the status of embryos only by public reason when they're considering abortion, which would be a sort of basic matter of justice and constitutional issue, and yet feel free to use religious grounds when they think about the same thing in developing an opinion about financing stem cell research. And a denial of funding in this instance may have a lot more influence on people's lives than a coercive rule against killing a member of some obscure endangered species. So I think one can't sort of draw a strict line and say it applies only to this and not to that. Now, ordinary citizens and officials. Citizens can affect public discussion and affect what laws are made. So one might think of the constraint of public reason should apply to them as well as to officials. But whatever might be true in some ideal future society, in this country, we don't have a tradition that precludes citizens from relying on religious grounds. And most people would be very hard put to distinguish what they believe on religious grounds from what they would otherwise believe. Now, no doubt, we should try to be aware of what grounds will appeal to fellow citizens. But any proposed sharp restraint on citizens, I think, would be misguided. Now, the public reasons constraint is essentially a self-constraint. There's no legal rule forbidding reliance on non-public reasons, and any attempt to enact such a rule would be at odds with both the free speech and the free exercise clauses of the First Amendment. Now, one aspect of the idea of public reasons is a kind of reciprocity. I won't rely on reasons that have no force for you if you won't rely on reasons that don't have force for me. But unfortunately, no one can be confident about what's really influencing other people. We can perceive what these people are expressing. Now, the impossibility of discerning the actual thoughts of others is one reason why it's better to view any constraint of public reasons as related to expressions rather than silently held grounds for positions. And there's also a more fundamental reason for limiting the constraint to expressions, or mainly to expressions. If most people are not really capable of excising their religious understanding from their political positions, it's unwise to insist that they do so. Thus, I believe the fundamental constraint should be for legislators and other public officials, and it should be mainly on their publicly urged reasons. They should be allowed some reliance on their own religious convictions and those of their constituents, but they represent a broader collection of citizens than those who have particular religious views, and they should be advocating in more general terms. Now, I've suggested that the precise coverage of the religion clauses has little to do with this issue about public reason. It's very rare, if ever, that a statute's going to be unconstitutional because it was supported by legislators or citizens on the basis of religious reasons. And since any restraint is voluntary, no one's exercise of religion is being limited by the government. But both clauses embody underlying values that are involved. One might well feel that part of the exercise of one's religion is giving effect to its moral implications. And trying to persuade someone that she should forgo that aspect of her religious convictions might be viewed as urging her to restrict her exercise of religion. And people who feel that laws are being enacted to restrict their activities because many people have a religious conviction that they should be, these restrictions should be placed on them, they may feel a religious outlook is being imposed on them. So related to this free exercise and establishment tension that we have is a crucial disagreement that people have over whether religious discourse about political positions enriches or undermines overall valuable discussion of issues. Some believe that this discourse is needed to overcome the superficiality of much political advocacy. But others think that people who rest on premises that other people don't accept or even understand, that this cuts off useful interchanges of ideas. So that's lurking there in the background as well. Now, how clear is the line between public and non-public reasons? Given a particular theory, some reasons will clearly fall on one side or the other. So a basic notion of political equality of citizens is a fundamental premise of liberal democracy. A belief that gay marriages must be forbidden because a particular biblical passage condemns sex between people of the same gender, that's not a public reason. But there are borderline instances that are not so clear, and natural law theory provides an illustration. As presently understood by most of its advocates, that theory rests on a comprehensive view of God's ordering of the universe and of human life. But natural lawyers typically claim that ordinary people can make sound moral judgments even if they lack a sense of these deeper matters. So it is a natural, is a natural lawyer's claim about the status of embryos, for instance, is that based on public reason? Well, that's not so easy to say. Now, what counts as a religious reason? What counts in the sense I'm talking about is a direct reliance on religious truth. And this leaves at least three kinds of connections to religions that could qualify as public reasons. If religious traditions over time are taking a similar view about a moral issue, such as parental responsibilities for children, that could be offered as evidence that that view is probably healthy for human society. A second reference to religion could be to employ a familiar story, such as that of the Good Samaritan, to appeal to the values of people. And a third connection would be a reliance on a deep-seated cultural value, such as monogamous marriage, understanding that its origin may lay in religious beliefs. Legislators have a reason not to upset or starkly violate such embedded cultural norms. Now, just how far the state should support those norms or accept individual adherence to them if they lack any modern defense in terms of independent public reasons is a very troubling question. Many now see same-sex marriage as raising such a question. What we can say is that a norm's being deep-seated in a culture is a public reason in favor of its maintenance, but one that can be overridden by solid claims of fairness and equality. Now, if someone finds public reasons convincing, may she add that she's also persuaded by religious grounds that she presents and defends? And I think the answer to that is clearly yes. And even political officials can acknowledge that they accept these supplementary reasons. And a constraint on public reasons is on how one arrives at political positions and defends them, not on how one decides to spend one's energies. One may devote one's energies to an issue because one thinks it's very important on some religious ground. And finally, the discussion so far, I haven't clearly distinguished between liberal democracies in general in the United States. And a lot of the theorizing on this subject has assumed that the same standard should apply to liberal democracies, all liberal democracies at all times. But I think that's mistaken. Whether or not citizens should rely on religious and other non-public reasons depends partly on the historical place of those reasons in the culture, prevailing attitudes toward diverse religions, and the degree of conflict along religious lines. So it may matter a lot whether there's a sharp conflict between adherents of different religions, one thinks of Northern Ireland or Bosnia, or religion has been a healthy unifying force helping to moderate other sharp divisions, as I think has occurred in South Africa. In the United States, religious efforts have had much to do with advances toward social justice, such as the abolition of slavery and the civil rights movement, and religion remains important for a high percentage of citizens. Religious divisions remain a source of social tension, but they're less significant in this respect than in earlier eras. Now, I think one has to examine these issues about public reason and religious reasons with respect to a particular culture at a particular point in time. Well, I'm going to now turn to the law. Is it a domain of public reasons? When judges make legal decisions, they are constrained, I think, by public reasons. What I want to emphasize today are three particular complexities that the public reasons for them are somewhat different than those for legislators, that the constraint is not complete, and that religion occupies a special place in relation to other non-public reasons in that context. So first, let me defend my basic position. Judges have to rest their rulings on existing laws and other reasons that all judges could be expected to accept. A vegetarian judge shouldn't be resolving a case involving the status of animals on vegetarian premises. And a judge faced with a custody battle between a divorcing couple should not decide against the mother because she worships in the wrong church or engages in acts that the judge's religious convictions condemn. Now, I was surprised some years ago to find resistance at a conference to the idea that law is about public reasons. This is something that's in Rawls pretty strongly. The competing idea was that law has its own special peculiar rules, something like the special rules of chess. And these are just peculiar to law, not public reasons. Now, I think this objection is misconceived. Judges often decide issues and apply legal standards using criteria that are not fully dictated by existing law. And determining which parents should have custody will be in the best interest of the child, which is the standard in virtually every state, is a notable example. Even when the existing law does not supply an outcome, we expect judges to rely on public reasons that they think would have forced other judges. We expect judges, insofar as possible, not only to articulate in terms of these reasons, but actually to decide on the basis of those reasons. Thus, I'm convinced that judges are constrained by genuinely public reasons. However, there is something to this self-contained idea that reveals how public reasons for judges differ from those for legislators. Judges rely substantially on what the law clearly provides, and even when a clear provision is absent, relevant precepts can provide guidance to them, precepts within the law. In deciding if behavior is unreasonable, judges rely partly on customary morality. Now, these norms count as public reasons, but the relevant legal rules and social customs may themselves owe their original status to religious convictions that don't rest on public reasons. We don't expect judges to figure out exactly how far norms of law and customary morality are themselves supported by independent public reasons and to disregard any norms that lack such support. Unless the norms are in conflict with constitutional rights or value, judges have less responsibility to assess them against modern public reasons than do legislators. We can thus imagine the following situation. We have a conscientious legislator who thinks she should restrict people's behavior only on the basis of public reason, at least if serious criminal penalties are involved. So she thinks on religious grounds that sexual relations between people and animals are deeply wrong. But she doesn't think there are public reasons sufficient to support serious penalties. So she opposes legislation on that basis, but nevertheless it's enacted. Then she gets appointed a judge. And she has to decide in a divorce case whether a husband's occasional unconcealed sex with a large family pet is a ground to award custody of the children to the wife. Now, at this point, I think the restrictive law is an aspect of her relevant public reasons as a judge. Now, a more subtle point about the judges is this. Sometimes all the public reasons will not provide an answer to particular issues, and at least arguably judges have to make an independent moral judgment. For judges making actual determinations here, I think religion is special. Judges are deciding for the state, at least if they're in the majority, or single judges. For them to rely directly on a specific religious reason is to violate, I think, the Establishment Clause or its spirit. And in this sense, I think religion differs from other non-public reasons as far as judging is concerned. Now, having said all this, I'd like to turn to these special problems of mixtures and assignments of weight. If public reasons are those that anyone relying on the premises of liberal democracy and accepted methods of determining facts can accept, we can quickly see that reasons that derive from some comprehensive views will have more weight in terms of public reasons than reasons that derive from other comprehensive views. And I want to develop two further points, that one who seeks to rely exclusively on public reasons may find that impossible because of the way that non-public reasons mix with these, and because public reasons alone can't determine issues of comparative weight sometimes. So the basic point about that different comprehensive views will connect differently to public reasons is straightforward. So let's suppose your comprehensive view is Jeremy Bentham's, that all political choices should be based on what will produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. Now, that in itself is not a public reason, because many people don't think that's the ultimate standard. But almost everyone agrees that human happiness is relevant to political choices. So at least for many issues, an argument that one decision will promote human happiness better than another counts for something. By contrast, an argument that we know from Scripture that God forbids sexual acts between persons of the same gender is not a public reason at all. It carries no weight for those who reject that comprehensive view. Now, the points I wish to make about weight and mixture are less obvious than that point. And I'm first going to illustrate these with reference to utilitarianism and then turn to religious convictions. John Stuart Mill considered himself a utilitarian, but his standard of judgment about restrictions on liberty was, quote, the permanent interests of man as a progressive being. Now, advancing people's capabilities and autonomy of choices won't necessarily coincide with maximum overall happiness. And I think Mill was quite clear about this implication because he was defending the liberty of people who engaged in free choice to perform actions like repeated drunkenness, which would make most actors miserable over most periods of time. So if Mill and Bentham were considering the future consequences of alternative choices, and both agreed that they should do only what's consistent with public reasons, how would they assess the consequences? Would not then each employ his own judgment about the consequences that would count? And would this not reflect his comprehensive view? Now, that's the problem of mixture. Even when one tries to stick to public reasons, it will be hard to avoid some input of comprehensive views in how one understands those reasons. The problem of weight is similar. Imagine that the two utilitarians agree on what counts as happiness, and that it's happiness that counts, and they agree what counts as happiness. But there are other premises of liberal democracy, such as the state should respect equality and some notion of giving people what they deserve. And on the first point, just to take that, the distribution of happiness matters. We can't make 5% of the population absolutely miserable in order to create great happiness for everybody else. The problem of weight is this: how should one weigh each of these criteria if they come into conflict? And it's hard to see how one can do this on the basis of public reason alone. Let me give an example from Rawls's own theory. He urges fair equality of opportunity, and that is that people who are born with the same natural skills should be afforded the same opportunities in life. Now, the American attitude about elite public schools, that they're acceptable for wealthy suburbs, and this is something from which I benefited as a child, this hardly conforms to this standard. But let us say the standard is really a genuine value of enlightened liberal democracy. Rawls sensibly recognized that this aim can never be achieved with nuclear families, because a person's upbringing in a family bears so heavily on her abilities and motivations. So if one accepts the value of nuclear families, he's recognizing that fair equality of opportunity is not as fully achievable as it might be if the children were raised differently. Now, when values like this, both recognized by public reason, are in genuine conflict, and both are substantial values, people are going to need to revert to their comprehensive views to assign weights precise enough to provide a resolution between the values, or so I claim. Now, here are similar problems with religious views. Religions widely teach that we should concern ourselves with the good of others. So suppose a person's comprehensive view is that this is indeed the ultimate standard of how people should make moral decisions, and that a moral or legal choice would benefit people is undoubtedly a public reason for choosing that way. But religious believers like utilitarians may disagree about what forms of goodness really count. If a legal rule encourages people to be generally concerned about the welfare of others around them, would that be more important than whether people achieve the full realization of their own capacities or are as happy as the general society can help them to be? Public reason, at least at any obvious level, is not going to tell us just which goods are really most important and just how important they are. A deeply religious person will be hard put to answer such questions without implicitly relying on her comprehensive view. And the end result, again, as with the utilitarian example, will be some mixture of public and religious reasons, here religious reasons. And if we could settle exactly which future-looking goods for people really do matter, We still have the question how the total amount of these goods relates to equality and desert and to other values of liberal democracy. If there should be a fair distribution with people counting equally, it doesn't tell us how we should accept a lessening, how much we should accept a lessening of overall good to achieve greater fairness. Again, in such deliberations, a person's comprehensive view is bound to affect just what weight she gives to the total realization of good in relation to these other values. If this analysis is correct, when it comes to decisions, we can't expect citizens or legislators to completely put aside their comprehensive views, religious or not, when they resolve problems. And something similar will be true for judges deciding on applications for which the law and customary morality fail to provide clear answers. Now, I want to highlight two underlying premises. And to just repeat a differentiation between judges and others. The two controversial premises are the limits of rational analysis on moral and political and even legal questions, and the incompleteness of premises of liberal democracy. I don't believe that for every moral, political, and legal question, there is one rationally derivable correct answer. Sometimes we all have to rely to an extent on our intuitive sense based on life's experience, a sense that may or may not be religiously formed. Of course, one could still tell people to rely on reason alone, especially if one thinks that people's intuitive sense is even less reliable than their reasoning powers. But I doubt if that's a wise recommendation. Encouraging people to rely exclusively on rational analysis may lead to undesirable degrees of self-deception, among other things. The second underlying premise against complete reliance on public reasons is that public reasons is radically incomplete on many practical issues. Public reasons do not tell us just how much we owe to animals or the point at which embryos or fetuses deserve protection, just to take those two examples. And they don't tell us just how principles of equal justice should be understood, how far, for example, the benefits of life should be distributed in a way that helps those that are worst off, sort of the Rawls position, or according to how much people contribute to what others value, a much more libertarian approach. What I've claimed relies both on the incompleteness of the premises of liberal democracy and on the inherent limitations of rational analysis. And if either of these skepticisms is accurate, that's going to preclude any assumption that liberal democratic premises will yield rationally derivable answers to all important political issues. Now, my claims about mixture and weight suggest that judges deciding custody questions also will not be able totally to rely any reliance on non-public reasons. But as I've said, because judges are making decisions about the coercion of the state, I think they should try to rely on non-religious reasons, even if they've got to get the non-public reasons. Now, one lesson for me is that all the difficulties we've seen help support the more general position that any public reasons approach that recommends exclusive reliance on public reasons, it's more suitable for express defense and justification of political positions than for all self-conscious decision making. However, I do think that in a liberal democracy, we should try to seriously consider public reasons and give them a special weight, that is, reasons that will have some force for all citizens. And I think this is especially true for legislators. Now I'm going to turn to the political candidate questions. If religion should not be a central component of political and legal decisions in a diverse liberal democracy, what does this imply about political candidates? How should they promote themselves, and how should citizens evaluate them? The quick answer may seem to be that religious convictions and affiliations should be treated as irrelevant. And that quick answer might be right, but if so, it's only because of concerns about misjudgment and prejudice. Just what roles religious background, affiliation, and conviction should play are very hard questions. There are strong competing considerations. And much could depend on political assumptions and alignments and particular political candidates. Now, I'm going to focus on candidates for president, assuming that a lot of what I would say would also have relevance for other official positions. So let's start with the candidates. If the government should not be promoting any particular religion, if officials are supposed to represent people of all religions, if political decisions and official expressions are grounded largely in public reasons, then for candidates to claim that their religion is an important reason to vote for them seems a bit troubling. Such a claim is likely to appeal primarily to those of the same or related faiths, and it implicitly divides voters of different faiths. Does it follow that a candidate's religious backgrounds and convictions are irrelevant? Well, not really. Candidates present their backgrounds in various forms, urging that features of these qualify them especially well for the office. For many people, their religious experiences and affiliations are an important part of who they are. If it's relevant whether a candidate came from a working class family, as Rick Santorum has emphasized about himself, or has had a successful life in business, like that of Mitt Romney, so also his religious life could matter. And both Santorum and Romney have presented themselves as people of faith with strong religious commitments. A recent column by David Brooks suggests the intrinsic importance of religious convictions for someone in the presidency. His basic idea is that an effective president needs to be emotionally secure and regard himself as an instrument of God's cause. Using examples of Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, he writes, and now I'm quoting, "Great leaders tend to have an instrumental mentality. They do not feel the office is about them. They are God's just temporary instrument in the service of a larger cause." And then that's the close quote. Now, given that possibility, all these possibilities, we need strong reasons to conclude that candidates should remain silent about their religion, their background, and affiliations. And for voters, a candidate's religious connections and convictions could be relevant in at least two ways. They could affect particular positions the candidate's likely to take as in office, and the way he reasons about novel problems. The first point is most obvious is if one's speaking of a church with hierarchical authority and definite positions on moral and political issues. If an official is a devout Roman Catholic, he's likely to think that same-sex marriage is undesirable. He's also likely not to be a libertarian, given the church's concern for the disadvantaged and for personal morality. Now, we can see the tie of religious convictions to the reasoning process by imagining someone who believes that the theory of evolution is completely wrong, that we should believe that what the Bible tells us, which is that all basic species of plants and animals were created at nearly the same time, and that was about 10,000 years ago. Now, I don't think the theory of evolution as it now is answers everything or precludes intelligent design and so on. I'm just talking about this particular strong version of rejecting it. So there are many branches of science that are just radically incompatible with the notion that we're only 10,000 years old and everything was created about the same time. Now, if a voter thinks that careful science is comparatively reliable, an official's complete disbelief in evolution could be disturbing. It could indicate that the official will not credit fairly convincing scientific conclusions in other domains, such as global warming or climate change. Of course, religious affiliations and convictions can be intrinsically relevant to someone's performance, but it doesn't follow that voters need to be left with inferences of the kinds that I've just suggested, the generalizations. Rather, the candidates can explain just how their religious views influence their public positions. We know that Governor Mario Cuomo, a devout Roman Catholic, supported a right to abortion, and his Catholic son strongly pushed New York's new law authorizing same-sex marriage. What candidates say is surely more reliable than their any uncertain generalizations. A fundamentalist Protestant who believes in the literal truth of the Bible could note the limited specific issues for which that would be relevant and say that he will be guided by science on all other issues. Should not voters be guided by what the candidates themselves honestly say about their positions and forms of reasoning as officials? Now, all this suggests that in some ideal world, candidates should provide a full explanation of how their religious convictions and affiliation fit with their perceptions of their official responsibilities. Unfortunately, ours is not this ideal world. Were religious convictions and institutional structures to be spread out in this kind of detail, we could expect the force of irrational prejudice against various religions and the generation of hostility among adherents of different religions to increase. Consider how healthy it would be if Mitt Romney's Mormon affiliation were developed in detail for public analysis and debate. We know that the resistance of some conservative Republicans to his candidacy relates to his religion. We would be naive not to suppose that such resistance would increase were his religion brought to the forefront. One may think in parallel terms about any candidate's atheism. In most parts of the country, it remains difficult for a professed atheist to be elected to office. Now, before offering tentative suggestions on these, I'm going to sketch some positions taken by John F. Kennedy, Mitt Romney, and Barack Obama. These provide possible approaches, and they reveal sharply the imperfection of any approach that one adopts. Kennedy stated his position in his 1960 presidential campaign. Romney's, as far as I'm aware, the thing I'm relying on was in his 2008 campaign for the Republican nomination. And what Obama said was when he was still a senator and before his initial run for the presidency. So it's not surprising that Kennedy and Romney were more focused on eligibility for office, and Obama's was more general. Now, at the time Kennedy ran for president, no Catholic had ever been elected president, and there was still significant prejudice against Roman Catholics, and his Catholicism was a potential obstacle to election. Before 300 Protestant ministers in Houston, he expressed his belief in an America in which ecclesiastical authority would not tell the president what to do and parishioners how to vote, in which religious affiliation would not be used by voters as a test for office, and in which the president's views on religion, and this is a quote, views on religion are his own private affair, not relevant to political decisions or a condition of holding office. In short, for Kennedy, religion would be private. Now, Kennedy managed to distinguish between his religious belief and his political responsibilities, but that's not the case with many officials and many voters. The influence of religion for an official can be much more encompassing than whether he or she will simply follow what someone in religious hierarchy directs or inevitably seek to implement religious perspectives. A devout Protestant might not regard what his minister says as conclusive, but still might give it considerable weight. No sensible official now would try to enact every moral conclusion that his religion teaches, and I think few who regard the use of artificial contraceptives as sinful would now think it's a good idea to actually legally forbid their use. But in instances of genuine doubt and division, one may well be influenced by one's religious convictions. And indeed, as I've suggested, it's actually very hard not to be influenced by one's religious convictions. Thus, for many officials and many voters, Kennedy's strategy of avoidance seems artificial. The proposal would discount matters that are relevant for at least some candidates and could potentially be significant for voters. One might still adopt his basic assumption as a necessary counter to unfounded prejudices, potential religion divisions, and overemphasis on religious inputs to political decisions. In his 2008 speech, Romney urged that candidates be free to provide an account of their religious faith. He saw religion as guiding moral sentiments and promised to, quote, offer perspectives on how my own faith would inform my presidency if I were elected. Now, claiming that churches in America shared a common moral creed and emphasizing his belief in the divinity of Jesus Christ, he also objected to the idea that a candidate should, quote, describe and explain his church's distinctive doctrines. Romney would limit political discussion to the candidate's position on public issues, discouraging careful appraisal or criticism of specific religious outlooks. Now, as others have suggested, this proposal is one-sided. He urges his faith as a basis to support his candidacy, but would preclude inquiries and critiques about the details of that faith. Now, if this were any other topic, we'd be likely to say, look, if you rely on a factor as establishing your suitability for a job, others should be able to examine details connected to that factor. Nevertheless, one can understand this theoretically awkward resolution. As a Mormon, Romney wished to emphasize all that Mormons share with other forms of the Christian religion. And one might think his proposal makes sense in terms of the significance of religion affecting somebody's life. And the negative side about not getting into details of religion could be justified as needed to avoid divisive scrutiny of the details of particular religious outlooks. In short, we have another division that's artificial in a sense, but could be thought suitable for our society at this time. Obama's 2006 speech claims that the believers, officials, and citizens need to, quote, need not leave their religion at the door when they enter the public square. He continues, and I quote, what our deliberative pluralistic democracy does demand is that the religiously motivated translate their concern into universal rather than religion-specific values. It requires that their proposals must be subject to argument and amenable to reason. Now, Obama did not make clear how rigorous his translation requirement is. I think surely it's not enough just for somebody to advance an argument in terms of public reasons that he thinks is completely specious. So I think that would involve deception, if not outright dishonesty. Thus, someone who opposes same-sex marriage on religious grounds shouldn't offer an argument that, based on the likely emotional harm to children raised within same-sex marriages, if that person doesn't believe there is any such harm. On the other hand, I'm assuming the translation doesn't require that you reduce your degree of confidence and the force that you make the claim with to what would be warranted if you relied exclusively on the universal values, that your sense of confidence that's right position could definitely be affected by your religious conviction. Now, that leaves the puzzle, which is whether Obama thinks the religious believer should decline to assert a position if he thinks the universal value is of some genuine force but not overall convincing by itself. Since he assumes that religious convictions will be playing a significant role in an official's understanding about what the government should do, I believe he was not insisting that the believer be fully persuaded by the public reasons he sets out, but I'm not sure about that. Now, the notion of translation obviously matters to some degree for candidates and for voters. If officials are to talk in terms of public, and again, Obama was not directing himself to campaigns in the way that Kennedy and Romney were, but if officials are to talk in terms of public reasons, that's also how candidates should generally approach issues. They should, they could describe their religious reasons, but really they should be suggesting, they should describe their religious background, but they shouldn't be suggesting that any particular religious outlook is needed for the presidency. However, even if all candidates adopted his translation norm, it wouldn't eliminate the relevance of religious convictions for voters. A voter could say this to herself: of course the candidate will use non-religious rhetoric, but only by understanding the religion will they be able to guess how much he will actually approach issues that are not now being debated. Now, this is true, I think, if we reflect on even candidates that rely only on arguments that actually persuade them, non-religious arguments. So, for instance, Roman Catholic natural law theorists, I think, believe their non-religious arguments against gay sexual relations, contraception, abortion, and embryonic stem cell research. I think they are convinced by those arguments. But I'm an outsider, and I think some of those arguments don't have much force. I think that their religious views are influencing their non-religious claims. So also, a voter might think that a candidate who will stick to non-religious translated formulations will still be influenced by what his religious beliefs are. So all this entails that if Obama's translation approach would deflect the searching inquiry about a candidate's religious affiliation and understanding, it, like the Kennedy and Romney approaches, represents a kind of compromise. It sacrifices inquiry about factors that could be relevant to a voter in order to minimize divisiveness and misunderstanding and prejudice. Now, where does this all this leave us? Because this is, as I say, a very hard question. If we lived in a completely tolerant society in which virtually all citizens had a sound sense of just how far religious convictions could bear on the performance in office, it would be healthy to have a full explanation of the religious aspects of a candidate's life. But we don't live in that society. And given this reality, I agree with all three of these, Kennedy, Romney, and Obama, that something is called for that we should recognize as a compromise. And I think the candidates for president should feel free to sketch their religious background as one aspect of who they are, but they should decline to suggest a tight connection between their religion and the suitability for office, and they shouldn't suggest that other religious views disqualify their opponents. If candidates observe these constraints, I think critics should also not delve into the religious life of candidates, and voters should accept making their decisions on the basis of public records and what the candidates say about public issues. If a candidate steps beyond this limit and proposes that his religious beliefs or associations make him particularly qualified to be president, then I think that should be taken as opening the door to voter examination of just what the candidate's religious group believes and practices, and how the candidate relates to these beliefs and practices. If a candidate who relies on his religious faith as an important qualification belongs to a Protestant group that accepts the Bible as literally true, he could be pressed to indicate just how far he thinks those truths bear on his public policy. And I think, you know, some of the statements that Rick Santorum has made about women choose to stay at home, women not being in combat, and so on, they've not been cast in terms of religious reasons, but he's also presenting himself as a person of deep faith, and it would be an interesting question how far his religious faith indicates that there is some significant difference between men and women in terms of what their public life should be. In sum, I'm recommending a compromise with all the information that could relevantly bear on how religious outlooks relate to the performance of official duties, a compromise that constrains both candidates themselves and commentators. But if candidates depart from this compromise, I think they can't expect others to refrain from deeper inquiry into the possible connections. Well, that is all I have to say. I really look forward to your questions and comments. Thanks.